This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Politician and poet Michael D. Higgins has published a collection of essays covering his work in public life, the arts and culture. The book is called Michael D. Higgins, Causes for Concern, Irish Politics, Culture and Society. We recently sat down and talked about some of the issues and topics he covers in this book. Both of us have been born in the West or lived in the West, and we now work in Dublin, and we find that there's a different concept of the West up here, Michael, isn't there? And there always has been.
I think that is so, because in the contemporary period, I would say in the 80s into the 90s, the dominant view of the West was going into wildness. And as the society has become more affluent in a city location, I argue that people don't understand the city either. And they have this notion of going to the West to try and, sometimes in the 80s, this is the difference, I think it was to recover some artificial version of innocence. But I think in the 90s it is they're more honest in a way, because it is to satiate their desires and lust and excesses in a far more open way. And it hasn't without its humour in a way. You know, you have Dublin people who are going to Roundstone who say, you know, we're going to Stone for the summer. Hmm. And there are all these little abbreviations and so forth. But if you take O'Fallon's original story, is it Lovers of the Lake, where, you know, they're having the affair. And she's going to go to Loch Derg, and is he not going to go with her, and so forth, or is she going to free herself from him? And they have this night, I'm not sure from memory whether it was of pleasure or guilt, in Galway, and so forth. And
it's a mix of both, I think.
It's a mix of both, yeah. So you can see the West is a displaced place. My interest in the book, of course, was in my own, no more than your own, for us, you see, for me anyway, using education as a passport out of where you are. And then I move on to, I'm now in the university and I go to America and England and so forth, and I encounter models that are supposed to explain how society hangs together and changes. And I come back and I find it really, the emphasis is on harmony and consensus and so on. And yet everything that I hear and know is about conflict over land, over religion, over the destruction of life. And above all else, it's not about stasis at all, no more than Connemara would be. The person who in Connemara who stayed in the one parish and never moved was a deviant, whereas, in fact, most of the people would have some time or another gone to England and come back and so forth. And they were the people who were, if you like, the majority. What I'm really saying was, all of the studies.
The image was based on the
image was the static.
And the static was the deviant.
Absolutely. And then you see, I found as well, which was very interesting, because I was only 28 when I began teaching in the university in Galway. And I found that there was no course in the social sciences on the sociology of migration. There was no course on the sociology of literature. So here we had facts surrounding us. Remember in the 1955-60, well, you wouldn't, but the reality of it is there, is that 50,000 people a year were leaving. So a quarter of a million people, most of them, had left from the west of Ireland. This flow, as it were, was being denied. But then the other side of it, which is interesting, is that as these models that were based on quantification and objective study and consensus and community was a big word and all of that, as they were ploughing away and launching themselves within this modernisation model of Ireland, you know, that everything had evolved into neatness and affluence and so on, at the same time you had grinding poverty.
But to go back to you,
yes,
the way you used literature in that chapter, you used the literature to describe the actual contemporary Gombin man.
I did, but you see, I have to say now, let me acknowledge my enormous debt to someone I was sharing a room with, a small room off the quadrangle in Galway University. You'll remember those small little rooms at the end of the library that I shared with the late Dr. Pat Sheeran. And Pat was finishing his PhD on Liam O'Flaherty. So in the course of it, we would be looking at all of the newspapers and so forth. And there you get an enormous contrast, which is wonderful in a way, in the way that O'Flaherty, in the character of Raymond Moore, looks at the west of Ireland, you know, in his novel, let's say, if you take The House of Gold, and then, or if you take Skerrett, again, which is a more successful novel, and so forth. And you think Flaherty's onto something there. He sees in Skerrett, for example, how the priest is dominated with disastrous consequences psychologically. But my interest began then, it moved out from The House of Gold, and I looked at others.
Yes.
Well, what I loved was in it, and you know, the part I remember was curiously a story I went back to. In a story I went back to in Flaherty was Two Lovely Beasts.
Oh, about the twin calves.
About the twin calves. And that's absolutely...
That's a fascinating story.
Well, it is,
basically,
yes.
It says like that there was a pishrog that says if twin calves were born to a house, it would be bad luck. But this
it
man...
It was, yes.
This man rears the calves and it gives him notions that he could become something else.
You notice something that's very interesting there too is how, if you like... circumstances can be seized on to just derive an advantage that doesn't take into account the bigger picture. Isn't it very like Mother Courage too, surviving to some extent at one point, although it's different in relation to Brecht's use
of that type of character.
But what I suppose I was doing, remember now when I wrote that piece first, I remember the debate that arose. You had people like the late and respected Professor Paddy Lynch and others. Lynch and Vasey had written their history of the Irish banking system. Different social scientists had written, and economists in particular had written about the neat evolution of Ireland and the famine. After the famine, how everything had kind of unfolded into the modern progressive society that you now had, and that it was a neat transition. I never said that what I was describing for the Gombeyan man was general in the society, but I said that it was in the periphery of the society where you didn't have access to credit. You had these relationships, and they really were usurious relationships. And I had an argument, if you like, with them about the nature of credit. They thought credit and banking is the way into the modern world. I argued that underneath the formal banking system was this deadly greed. And then I decided to go back, and I went back indeed to the man you mentioned. I went back to Carleton's Darby Skinader. And what I was looking for, which is very interesting, I was looking for the word Gombeyan, because while Darby's a miser, he's not referred to by this word. And I had a debate about the word, and I remember relying on De Waldre to solve that one, because where did the word come from? And there was a word in Connemara called a piece on the gambie, which is the extra piece on the 2 ounces of tobacco when you cut it with a bowie knife. But De Waldre rejects that, and he comes out in favour that it's cambium, cambiare, to the
change.
Latin word to change
money.
And that it is a usurious relationship based on change. So then I kind of brought it into the modern period, and I was looking at, I suppose, if you take at the end of the 19th century and into the period of Irish independence, you take Brinsley McNamara and Brinsley and the clanking of chains. The wife and are looking out and they decide that the new state is going to catch on, so it is safe to put out a flag. So what do you notice what I'm saying really is that I'm drawing in what I'm really suggesting, and I do so again at this stage of my life, is that it is quite extraordinary that in Ireland you just wouldn't have just the facts of social movements and people emigrating, but that you had a rich source of information and insight and understanding in the literature. And here were people being trained empirically, as it was called, to look at their world within a set of blinkers. I refer to it in the book, I think, as a spancel, which is placed, if you like, on the Irish social sciences. So I wasn't suggesting ransacking the literature for evidence, really. What I was suggesting was that maybe writers are able to see the destructive properties of a society. And certainly in MacGaharan, in the modern period, There is a love of nature and of the rural life in McGaharan, but there's an inexhaustible sadness, I find, in it, at any event.
Absolutely. But it's an interesting... I suppose only recently that science has been looking towards art and literature. All sciences now look toward literature and contemporary accounts to make judgments on what happened in the past. And the canon of writers that you brought here, they seem to give a truer account or a truer feeling of what the West was like than contemporaneous government accounts or reports or so on.
Well, I think there are two big elements in it that you know... that I don't resolve, but that I think I state the question. And I'm influenced now by John O'Donoghue in the modern period, of John O'Donoghue of Anam Cara and Divine Beauty. He has a good line, I think, suggestion in a paper that I know he wrote that he hasn't published yet, and that it is the good question that keeps the half-baked answer alive, you know, in a way. The question is the important thing. And... I just wonder, you know, if you take it that writers and philosophers, you know, are always reminding us, they're not always reminding us, but some of them are, some of the time, when they ask the good questions, I feel, that the potential of what we are, what is possible in the world, what I would call, if I was in a technical setting, the poetic possibility, that's what John calls it, is there continually. And what we actually deliver is very much less than that. But to have dreamed and imagined and to have seen the alternative, even temporarily at the level of the imagination, is a better life than to have elevated the very limited version of what is to the sublime, you know. That is in a way what happens when people become consumers rather than citizens, or become people who are, if like, materialists rather than people who are participating more generally in the culture. Now, that is a real issue. And the other side of it, which I think is very interesting to me as well, is the concept of ruin and the concept of man and nature anyway, all human attempts to construct versions of that are temporary, they're powerful, powerful, powerful suggestions. I have in the poems, you see, and people will find in this book, in the early sections, a kind of context to the three collections of poems, particularly the first two, in which I was obsessed for a long time about the image of the abandoned house and the narrative of that the house left, the fire isn't lit, and then the rain makes its way inside and the soot comes out through the gable. And you see the soot on the gable as the house is preparing to be a ruin. Well, we are all at some stage, you see, ageing too. And that, in fact, is, if you like, the great challenge of being able to envisage our temporary attempts as being the makings of a ruin. And you often heard it, did you ever hear it? I think it is in one of the plays, I can't remember, about somebody that he or she was a great ruin of a person. But what it has in it is a suggestion of life having been lived, but more importantly, of life having been attempted. And the attempt is what is important. The attempt is what is in literature, and the attempt is what makes us human.
It's the challenge.
Absolutely.
And regardless, that is regardless of. But I suppose that's part of our thinking as Irish people, you know, our traditional thinking, well, especially in the West, like that we will not own the world, but we'll challenge other people's rights to own it.
The very last paper that Raymond Williams gave when he was alive was Be the Arrow, Not the Target. That's the one he gave at the Celtic Filmmakers.
Yes.
And I use it
which the idea was that you should become the motivator or the force rather than being on the receiving end.
Yes, you're not just the consumer of the product. You should be, in the course, this is the one that would set all of the broadcasters back on their heels, because it's the difference between public service broadcasting at its best and consumer broadcasting. But his other one was, in his final book towards 2000, he says something I think of the other: it is when the inevitable is challenged, we have taken our first small steps in a journey of hope. and questioning the inevitable. There was nothing inevitable about immigration from the west of Ireland that we both come from. There was nothing inevitable about the one person owning everything in the parish. In fairness, Mike,
the west of Ireland that I come from is still being decimated. There's no employment west of Inverness, you know.
Well, what is, you see, this is part
and the little bits and pieces that are there, the fishing industry's been decimated, the farming or whatever, the little bits of farming, turf cutting, whatever. And well, even the forestry, the alternative industries, are damaging to the environment there, so they're sugared either way.
Well, you see, the two things that you, I would say about it is the way, if you like, in which general descriptions defeat the truth. For example, you would say that, like, some people say that unemployment is at 4.5% or something. But you and I both know areas where it is 40%. You might, people say as well, now everyone is, extreme poverty has been eliminated. But again, the areas that where you have high unemployment are areas of multiple deprivation, both in terms of literacy, in terms of children's opportunities, in terms of education, in terms, indeed, even of nutrition. Isn't it interesting that in 2005-06, when they began providing breakfasts on the north side of Dublin City, school attendance went up because the children were coming to school to be fed.
It's also interesting at the same time that most of the bakers, traditional bakers, are going to the wall and they're importing factory-made bread of poor nutritional quality to most houses around the country. But that's like...
Well,
I blame the craft bakers for that, for allowing that to happen.
Well, it is... I think the one of
Why do we got the stage, Mike, and we don't even value decent bread?
Well, that half-baked dough is what comes in. You kind of finish it off in the country. It is, of course, it also illustrates something else. It is not a case of moving out of the present into the past, where I remember in County Clare, when all the work of the day was done, the woman started baking endlessly. So there is endless baking and so forth. I argue that it is a mistake to say that, you know, it was all right in the past, because why? I have a piece in it where I say that if God was an Irish God, he would hardly have created a woman with a bucket at each end of her hands, you know, and the things. So I also, in the poems, remember, write about people for women for whom the electricity came too late to straighten their backs. And so, but you are right. What it is about is the degree to which we can put a human intention in place. What I think is totally destructive is the suggestion that you are moving through an evolutionary wave which cannot be questioned. And, you know, one of the great powers of art, one of the great powers of writing and of theatre and of music and the visual arts itself, is its subversive quality of undoing the basis of that bogus assertion of the inevitability. It is, in fact, if you like, making the category of truth open to question. And that's really what all art is about, as far as I'm concerned.
How did you discover your poetry? How did you discover being... How did you realise you were a poet? Or when did you realise you were a poet?
No, it was a matter of when did, I suppose, that form suit me. I think the very first thing I wrote, and even when I was in university in that, I wrote short stories. Curiously, the short story is what interested me most. And the short story that I was particularly interested in was the Russian long short story, say, as used by Frank O'Connor. I preferred O'Connor, curiously, to O'Fuelon. I liked Steinbeck. And I think it was sometime in the 70s, I began writing The Betrayal, that long poem that's in my first collection. And it took me nearly 10 years to before I finished it. And I remember, truthfully, finishing it on the train between Galway and Dublin. I was now at this stage in either the Dáil or the Seanad. The Dáil, I think it would have been. No, it was in the Seanad, I think I was. And I remember weeping, because in a way the long poem had taken me over. And there wasn't a way in which I could restrain my own grief in the poem, or my own terrible repressed rage at the waste of it all. Remember what I was describing. I was describing...
Tell us what you were describing in The Betrayal.
Well, I was describing in that poem more than anything. I was describing the death of my father. I was describing more. No, I was describing an action of my own in a split second when I went down from Galway to, we at this stage had moved into just a railway cottage, which had one room and then one bedroom. And that, and the one I, in the line in the poem I say that the fact that the coffin couldn't come out the front door was a factor in the thinking about my father being in hospital and so forth. And my father had gone into the county, to the ordinary hospital, and was moved to the county home, as I say in the poem, not dying fast enough. And I went down to visit him. I persuaded him to go into hospital. So that was one betrayal. But then I visited him in hospital, and I saw all of these people. My father, remember, had been, with his brothers, it's in the book, had been in the War of Independence, and he had been on the Republican side, and he had spent his time in Newbridge and the Curragh and so forth, and couldn't get a job when he left, and had couldn't go home to his own parish. This is what really just riled me about the consensus people, you know. They had all changed. My father couldn't, it wasn't safe for him to be outside mass on when he came out of the Curragh and that. So what I'm saying about the betrayal then, there was the betrayal, therefore, if you like, of the version of the state that came in to being. And really, I have a point in it, that if I might just say this in case I forget it, because it's very important. One of the things that's important to me to this day was the manner in which many middle-class people from UCD sailed into the leadership of the new Irish state. And to this day, they have not recognised that the people who took part in the War of Independence were the shop boys, were the people who were under indentured service in the different towns, who, because they were congregating together with hurleys and often with one gun or two, burned Kilmallock barracks like my father did and others. So they never get credit, if you like. And you have all this revisionist rubbish about suggesting that they are people who are maliciously violent, psychotic people, while in fact actually the people to whom the state could be handed from empire were people who had come from the universities and so forth. And UCD had a great migration itself. The whole lot of them practically went in and became a conservative government that absolutely stamped on artists. As Declan Kybert says, you know, somewhere, the new state was no place for Bohemia.
When the new state, the first thing the new state was to try to recreate an image of what an Irishman was, of what to be Irish was. And again, the West was central to that image making, with Sean Keating doing drawings, with Yeats's Fisherman, and, you know, the Laverty Pound Note was all Irish, Colleen, like, you know. Were they deliberately?
You know what some of the, about the Irish language people they don't realise either is, in relation to Love Songs of Connacht, Don Ta Grá, when that came out, there was a big debate about the movement.
This is Douglas Ta Hedges.
Yes, Douglas Ta Hedges, yes, indeed.
The first president of the new state.
Yes, well, before, when he wrote the Love Songs of Connacht, there was a big debate in the Irish language movement, and they said it would be better that the language would perish than these troublesome thoughts be brought out. Which
that was because
thoughts
of the,
about
the
sensuality.
Sensuality. And, there was girls involved in that, Michael.
Yes, indeed there were, and as we know, in fact, actually, the pure, clean Irish that had been descended from chieftains, and that had only been momentarily interrupted by the flight of the earls and so forth, was going to be created again. So you would have Ireland, in which would be noble. And
there'd be no running around in the Rhine.
Oh, no, not at all. And then the other side of it, which actually is amazing to this day. I remember when I was minister, you know, down taking over one of these houses that had been handed back to the state and so forth. People got very upset about it as well. And I said to the people, you know, at this stage there was a kind of a fetish in Ireland in the 90s that they all would like to think that they were in the big houses. They were inventing paths for themselves. It isn't only the new state that invented, had an antiquarian version. There are a lot of the new rich Irish, you know, who like to think that they came from the big house. And as I pointed out, their ancestors would have got the smell of the soup at the end of they would have cleaned the tureens, or they would have, as I said at that stage, they were more likely to be people who had done wonderful work on the stones, building the gates.
Yes.
So, but you see, there is this interesting notion about it, about Ireland and class. In my study, for example, you know, I have there's another difference between myself about the interpretation of Máirtín Moore MacDonagh and Galway.
This is the guy that Raymond was based on In the House of Gold by Liam O'Flaherty.
Well, we have to be careful, but we let us say there's O'Flaherty was very well aware of Bartramore MacDonagh and his uncle's activities when he was crafting the character of Raymond Moore.
Fair enough.
All right, but when you come to Galway in the thing, you know, when he died, the local paper had a black border around it. You know,
this is the guy that, let's be clear about this, is the guy that owned the majority of the industry in Galway, ran the docks, banned labour unions, broke strikes, had shops and shopkeepers in debt, ran a book for half the town. And the only thing you could be sure was, if you worked for Marching Moore, they'd put a coffin on you when you died.
Well, I wrote about that. I remember a clad woman telling me who her phrase on that was when he said to her about the coffin and that, and she said, "You owned him while he was alive, you might as well box him when he's dead." Now, at any event, anyway, about this, he died in 1934, but his horse won, I think, the Galway Plate. And it'll show you about this notion about the attitude to wealth and money. In Gwynne's book about the Galway, essay on the Galway races, he says, "All the people cheered, and they said, 'Lead him in yourself, Mr. Martin.' So there have been always those who will crawl to the money. And they are with us to this day. But in December 34, when he died, the editorial of the paper said, 'Gloom has been cast over Galway and indeed over the West, whose sloping hills and green valleys he loved so well by the death on Saturday at his home, Belmore, Salt Hill, of Mr. Martin MacDonagh, TD, FG. Martin Ward, as he was universally known in the county, was one of the greatest men of the West, as his wonderful business record goes far to prove. He was son of Mr. Thomas and Mrs. MacDonagh, Lethermullen, was educated at Tullybeg College, Offaly. Passing on to a great career, he became senior partner in the MacDonagh Milling and Trading Company, MacDonagh Chemical Works, and the sawmills of Thomas MacDonagh and Sons. He was chairman and principal shareholder in almost all the local industries, including the reopened Galway Woolen Mills and the Galway Foundry and Engineering Company. For a number of years, he was chairman of the Galway Urban Council and Harbour Commissioners, and a member of the Galway County Council and the governing body of University College Galway, and president of the Galway Chamber of Commerce." And then the loss, the grief. "We shall miss him sadly in these days when men like him are needed to rebuild the country that he loves so well, according to his lights. Aside from his great public services, in which he never wavered once, he had made up his mind to the right. He was a king among industrialists, in an alpine village since perhaps, but nonetheless a king. If he had not Midas's gift of making gold, he was endowed with talents and perspicacity that stood him in good stead throughout a business career of half a century," and on and on. So, you see...
But amongst the labour unions of Galway, he was the most hated man that ever walked.
Well, I suppose they would, were inclined, I suppose, to say, and there's a lot to it, "De mort vis nil nisi bonum," but it is true.
And I'm here talking to Michael D, and we're talking about the West. You've been a TD representative back in Galway West now for many years. 10 years ago, was it? You set up TG Carr in the polling district of Tulla, I believe, in the Baile of Ballinahown. An investment in excess of 20 million at the time. And I believe you got 4 extra votes in the polling booth in Tulla at that time. Wasn't that a costly 4 votes, Michael?
Well, it was never done for that reason. One of the things about the TG, Tina G, as I know it was, I think it's very important for the history of the thing to respect the impetus of the Feachtas. I think it's only fair to the people of Connemara. It's irrelevant whether they vote for me or not, but it's important that the truth be known, that in relation to Radio na Gaeltachta, it was a community initiative that went against the tide and set up something that enabled it to the thing that became the state-sponsored thing. And in exactly the same way, it was the Feachtas, or it was the movement for the right to communicate in the Irish language in a televisual medium that set everything up. Then you had the different parties who in the 1992 had it in their election manifestos. And even now, you know, there's a kind of a revisionism that goes on that says, well, everyone was really in favour of it and all the politicians were in favour of it. The truth of it is that Fianna Fáil ministers, after they had left the government, meeting together, took a decision in favour of Tina G. But there was no cabinet decision. And then in 92, when you had the election, in 93, when I became minister, I prepared the first aid memoir to go to the cabinet for the first decision about Tina G in principle, and I got that. And then I realised that the Department of Finance were going to be completely obstructive. And when that government fell, in writing the manifesto for the next government, I actually wrote it more cleverly in a way that they couldn't deny me the money, because I was opposed day, every day for Bartinigi by the independent group newspapers. And part of the attack would be to ask me how was I funding it. The trick was this. The Department of Finance had assumed that the money that had been accumulated under the cap on broadcasting that Burke had brought in, that I would be confined. I could only use that, as it were, for capital purposes. But I had said in the second version in the second government that it could be used to start Teenage, and I didn't specify whether it was capital or current. So I could always say it. I could always start the thing up. And I had a simple, kind of fairly peasant view that if it has came up and started, they'd find it very difficult to close it down. And the other big battle at that time, I remember my difficulty, curiously, was I was fighting on two fronts, because I had earlier, if you remember, I had earlier been dealing with Section 31, and I ended the order under Section 31, and when I decided not to renew the order, once again I had people telling me that I was unleashing terror on the state and that everyone was going to join the provisional IRA and democracy would
fall apart.
Well,
in fairness, didn't do badly out of it, but go on anyway.
No, well, I think the point about it is that the challenge was always there. People must be asked hard questions, and people must have the capacity to put the hard questions, and so be it. I suppose, do you know what it really always was all about? Trust. Do you trust the listeners or the viewers? Do you trust the people to ask the questions? Do you trust the authority that is there, that is supposed to be in charge of public service broadcasting? And, you know, the whole question about RTE itself, where a very sizable number of people in RTE were very happy to work under the order of Section 31. And you could not assume that I was really making a broadcaster's case. There were broadcasters who liked the order.
Of course.
And you know, and they're still there.
You're in the second half of your life.
Well, that's very generous of you, yes, indeed, yeah.
Is there a prejudice against old people? Are old people valued enough in our society? Is there enough respect given to elders?
I think that it's very, one of the most interesting things is that, in contemporary Ireland treats its older people, is about to treat its older people terribly. The idea that you should be wondering how you're going to pay for your last days. We won't go down the road of having to sell your house to pay for it, yes, and that stuff, or being taxed after you're dead. We are getting this charged set of divisions that are based, if you like, on physical energy and so forth. And I think that that is a great pity. Most people, 4 out of 5, want, for example, to spend the last years of their life in their own home. It has nothing to do with the business about where they are in a physical sense, but the objects which are intimate to them are on dressers. The things that they made are around. They know the story of every object. They know how all the spaces were occupied, about who used to sit in that chair when he was alive and so forth. So to suggest that you can reduce the human life that is expressed on that social space as an asset is just so outrageous. It's based on a complete ignorance of the nature of life of an older person.
On that, Michael D. Gonna meet him,
Michael. Michael D. Higgins' book is called Michael D. Higgins, Causes for Concern, Irish Politics, Culture and Society, with a foreword by Declan Kyburn, and it's published by Liberties Press. Kay Sheehy produced tonight's programme. From all of us in the 11th Hour,
you've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.